Now, your noontime check-in with today's business world and more. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN. Here's Steve Bertrand.
And welcome to Monday afternoon here in the Allstate Showcase Studio. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch version number one for the week. We start on Mondays always with the folks from Chicago Inno. Jim Dahlke and Catherine Davis are in the studio. A little bit later, we'll hear from Randy Schaefer. She's a digital editor at the Chicago Tribune and talk about some social media stories there, including paying for Facebook. What about that? We'll kick that around a little bit later. But right now, we say hello to Catherine and Jim. Welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Hey, Steve.
Hey, Steve.
I'm glad you're here because there was word today about Howard Tolman. We followed Howard Tolman and the fact that he was leaving 1878. And
71.
And now we know where he's going to go. Tell me about that, Jim.
Yeah, so Howard Tolman, the serial entrepreneur, investor around town, has got his next act in place here. So he's going to take over as the executive director of the Ed Kaplan Family Institute of Innovation and Tech Entrepreneurship at Illinois Institute of Technology.
And I know they're friends of the program. In fact, they sponsor your visits from time to time. So this is sort of a nice landing for him and a nice pickup for them, I would think.
For sure, yeah. And, you know, it's funny that Howard Tolman at 72 even wants to do another thing, but this guy is like, you know, the most like motivated gung-ho dude right. in Chicago, right? It's like the serial entrepreneur that just won't quit. So he's on to his next venture here. Obviously led 1871 for several years, really made it kind of the epicenter for what's going on here in the technology
scene. And what he was a public face on it, right? And so that's what he can do there.
Yes, and he was really very good at that. Right. Yeah, I mean, he brought in, you know, world leaders were stopping by 1871. Howard Tolman made sure that everybody was kind of coming through those doors to kind of get a sense for what was happening in the startup community here in Chicago. So certainly you think that he's going to help shine a light on what's going on at Illinois Institute of Tech.
And things are going pretty well, right, Catherine? The numbers are in for the first quarter as far as venture capitalist expenditures. Not too shabby.
Yeah, Illinois just had its best Q1 in terms of total venture funding since the first quarter of 2000. So that's pretty big. In the first quarter of 2018, more than $375 million was invested across 36 deals in Illinois.
So that's a good first quarter for us, but it's not as good as we've been doing in the most recent quarters.
Yeah, like the last three quarters of last year, actually, more money was raised. About, you know, over the course of them, it was $871 million in the second quarter of last year, $424 million in the third quarter, and $423 in the fourth.
Is the first quarter typically slow?
That's what we've seen, right? So I don't know if it's a trend in kind of across the country, but it's certainly kind of been the trend here locally is that the first quarter tends to get off to a slow start. So, the amount funded is kind of a tricky stat because, you know, one or two monster funding deals can kind of throw this off. But the deal volume is something to really take a look at too. I mean, how does the deal volume kind of compare to?
And volume was up.
Right. So volume is stayed at a decent pace for Illinois, and that's really what you want to look at. I mean, sure, like, you know, a company that raises $100 million is going to throw off the total funding amount, but I mean, looking at the number of startups getting backed is an important stat to look at as well.
And Catherine, how do we rank nationally when it comes to volume in the first quarter?
Yeah, well, Illinois is ranked sixth in deal volume, behind big tech places like, you know, California, San Francisco, New York, Massachusetts, but seventh in total amount raised. So,
oh, good. Okay. So not too shabby. Another company that just picked up some money was Ballot Ready. And Ballot Ready, well, are they going to be ready for the midterms?
That's their plan. So they raised $1.5 million in a seed round, and they say that's going to help them expand their voter guide platform to all 50 states by the fall midterm elections.
Jim, so there are, according to Ballot Ready anyway, 500,000 elected officials in this country. Maybe it's time to look at that. but they argue that they can be the go-to tool to help voters figure out, especially down ballot contests.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, I don't know about you, but I've certainly walked into the voting booth and had zero idea about some of these like really, really down ballot sort of races, right? And so what they're trying to do is make sure that every voter who walks into the voting booth knows exactly who they're going to vote for by giving them the kind of detailed information.
How do they do that without taint, right? Without being, you know, the Democratic Party might offer me this or the Republican Party. How are they going to offer something that they can guarantee is I mean, I don't know how you can be perfectly objective.
So what you do is you each candidate breakdown kind of has like, you know, who they're endorsed by, where they stand on certain issues. So there's really no political bias that comes into this. This is truly straight down the middle. I mean, I used the product for the primary in Illinois. Actually, they ended up working with about 7% of the voters in the primary election the other month, which 7% kind of sounds low. But actually, the fact that they've done very little marketing and we're still able to reach 7% of the primary voters who are typically older and maybe less inclined to like even know what ballot ready is.
Did you see the way he looked at me, Catherine, when he said that? That was kind of weird.
Pointed the finger right at you. But so the fact that they were able to get to 7% of the voters in Illinois is still pretty impressive.
What I like is they've got David Axelrod on the advisory board, who worked with Obama, obviously, out of Chicago, and Mike Murphy as well, who's a Republican operative who I've watched for years and years. So it looks like they're making a real effort there.
Yeah, some smart political folks are into what they're doing. So that's certainly a vote of confidence for them.
Tell me about, here, Kath, did you do any writing last week? Because all the stories seems like Catherine wrote all the stories.
A good manager delegates,
Oh,
Steve.
I see. Let me watch like this. So, Catherine, tell me about this story, about this company,
Treina, yeah.
And they are involved in helping companies deal with sexual harassment policy, but they're giving away the product here for a while?
Yeah, so basically what they do is they are an enterprise software company, and they provide professional learning and development services to companies of really all sizes. But what they started doing this month is offering free anti-sexual harassment training specifically to startups, so companies with less than 20 employees, you know, who typically don't have HR departments or formal policies in place, and kind of helping them, you know, reduce the possibility of a toxic work culture forming.
We're sitting in a building of a company, right? The Trunk has been going through that with their leading shareholder, was busted and just had to leave the company, Michael Farrow, and all of that. So that's with the big companies. Philip Weiss, who comes in from time to time and advises companies about policy, says it's always key to do it early on. When the company is small, establish something and then grow it from there. If you wait too long, then you've kind of waited too long.
It's really important for companies, especially startups, to really nail the culture from day one. And culture doesn't just mean like we go out to drink on Fridays, right? Your culture is everything from, you know, how you handle yourself in the workplace and the policies that you set up in terms of sexual harassment, right? So really focusing on that early on is important. As startups, really all you're focused on is grow. But there are a lot of other things that you have to worry about when you're putting together, you know, a safe environment for your work, for your employees. So the fact that a lot of local startups are using this free service is interesting.
All right. I bought something at the Gap over Christmas, and I've been inundated with emails from the Gap and Gap Cash and all of that ever since. And there's nothing worse than looking at one of their ads online and then, because I still want to try the clothes on, you know, and going to the store and they don't have the sizes, they don't have anything there. There's a new company that Catherine wrote about that we're going to, that solves all those problems. We'll kick that around in just a second.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch with Steve Bertrand, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
It's 12:52 here in the Allstate Showcase studio. Okay, so back to me in the Gap. So I go to the Gap, I see these shorts I want, and they never have my size. I don't know if this is exactly what this company 545 is out to fix, but I think they're on to something. Tell me about 545.
Yeah, so Style 545, they are an 1871 startup here in Chicago. And basically what they've done is they've created a software that retailers can incorporate onto their platforms that lets consumers pick out clothing, reserve it at the store, and go and try it on in person. And so this kind of fixes that problem of constantly ordering clothes online, them not fitting, and having to send it back, or you know, what people are going through.
And you don't like to do that. We can tell Jim does, because nothing really fits him right.
I am a strict, I have to try it on before I buy it.
You got to feel the cloth. You got to have a little sensitive encounter there.
Exactly.
And so through this, I don't know if this is exactly what they intend to do, but you can then check to see what inventory is at the store near you.
Exactly, because they can only reserve something that's actually in the store at that time.
Right, and then the software, what's 545, where does that come from?
So they got that inspiration from, because that's usually like the average amount of time someone is spending in the dressing rooms, 5 minutes and 45 seconds. And so they're working to reduce that.
I like that.
Because that's too high.
Jim, what's the longest you've ever spent in a dressing room and why?
Oh boy, I don't know. 5 seconds.
So I like this. And then the other thing is they will take what you've purchased in the past, right? And mm-hmm. it's like a color form. They'll create a nice little outfit for you on the app that you can sort of look through. And
yep. So it definitely has a styling component, you know, based on what you're into and what you're not. It'll be like, well, here's some other suggestions.
They won't put them on someone who looks like me, though. That's the problem still. It's still a 22-year-old jock. So that's an issue we'll have to deal with later. New Quarters is this, what are they, a German company? Is it Germany?
Yes. German-based co-living provider.
So we've talked a lot about co-living on this show. Jim, explain for me just quickly what co-living is and why it's taking off.
So think about co-living like a dorm, but for people who aren't in college anymore. So you get your own bedroom in a building, but you share some amenities like bathrooms and kitchens and common areas.
And the appeal is that it's not long-term.
Right. You can get as little as 3-month leases, so you're not locked into a 12-month living situation. The price is typically a little bit better than what you would find for a one-bedroom place. And these they're popular in cities like San Francisco and Seattle and New York, where you know the rent is really gotten out of hand. And so, you know, maybe you're there for an internship. Maybe you just need a kind of a temporary living situation and it's a little more affordable.
And now, Catherine, this company New Quarters is coming to town and they're planning big stuff around the world.
Yeah. So they're, the new Chicago location will be in the Fulton Market neighborhood, kind of like the West Loop area. And this building is going to house 175 residents across 75 apartments. And so they say those are ranging from like studios to 5-bedroom units. So you can have a ton of roommates essentially, or kind of do the more solo thing, but you'll still be sharing those common spaces.
And they plan, they said, to manage homes in every major U.S. and European city within the next 2 years.
Yep, that's their plan.
If they can do that, then that's a sign of this is a wave, right? I mean, is this going to be the way post-collegiate graduates live for a couple of years?
I think that depends on how rent generally is going to change, right? Like, so say, you know, let's say, for example, Amazon decides they're going to set up shop in Chicago. That's going to change the price of your rent around town, right? So I think the more expensive rent gets, the more affordable, the more attractive something like this
becomes. But it's not really a bargain, right? I mean...
It just kind of depends. Like, you know, it would be hard to find a 1-bedroom in the West Loop for less than... $1,200,
which is what their price starts at.
So it would be a bargain in that case.
But you could find something like that if you moved up to Lakeview or, you know, Pilsen or a different neighborhood. So it's just kind of like relative.
What I like about these companies is their pitch, and maybe it's true. I just have a hard time with it. Like, they talk about how they're not selling just rooms. They're selling this sort of culture, you know, the whole building becomes this cohesive sort of unit and they go out and do fun stuff together. Does that really happen, or is that just the marketing?
I mean, it's the dorm style living for the 23-year-olds, right? So I mean, I think it kind of depends. Like,
but they talk about how they have clubs and they have group outings.
If you're new to a city, you know, you've been transferred here for work and you don't know anybody, you know, it's an attractive option, right? Because you're immediately like forced to meet people and make friends, right? So I mean, I don't think it's for everyone, obviously, but you know, if you're new to a city, you're trying to really kind of expand your network. I mean, it's an interesting option.
Yeah, I would agree. It's good for people that are trying to acclimate to a new place.
Okay, so let's do this one more time then. Is this something that's going to be, are we at the very beginning of something that's going to be transformative for the way people live? So in 20 years from now, is this going to be typical?
Get the price down. So I think that $1,200 probably for Chicago is even still like a little too much on the high side. If you can get that down a couple $100, like then you're starting to really change the way people think about living, because if the price becomes that much more enticing, then you're going to really start to see like, okay, well, I'm willing to share a kitchen with a stranger if I can save a couple $100 on rent.
Right.
So,
Catherine, what do you think?
Yeah, I would say so.
Yeah, I think I like the idea if you're, like my daughter, she's still thinking of going to LA. She wants to, so everyone wants to go to LA, right? This would be appealing to people who are going to go out there to try to find a job, live for a few months, and then come back to their parents' basement.
Yeah, I mean, people have been doing the Craigslist style, like couple month, you know, couch surfing thing for forever. This kind of makes this a little more legitimate, I guess, right? And kind of gives you a better short-term lease option.
Jim Dahlke and Catherine Davis, Chicago Inno. People read these stories where?
ChicagoInno.com, and sign up for The Beat, our daily newsletter.
A cool newsletter. And what's that thing you do every morning?
5:25 in the morning on the opening bell. It's the Inno Minute.
Now, your noontime check-in with today's business world and more. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN. Here's Steve Bertrand.
It is 12:37 as we sit here in the Allstate Showcase studio on this beautiful show. It's beautiful to someone, I'm sure, Monday afternoon in April. All right, if you watch TV, if you listen to music, you probably are familiar with the work of my next guest. In fact, this will help refresh your memory a little bit. The Gatorade jingle. Ira Antelis is in the studio. Welcome. How are you?
I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you so much.
So that's that jingle, the Gatorade jingle for Michael Jordan, right? That's what you do. So you wrote a song for Patti LaBelle, Christina Aguilera.
Yes. My career has mostly been in music, which is why being here talking about a drink is sort of a turnaround in my life.
Right. And so are you still writing music?
Yes.
How is that business?
It's very, very different because, 20 years ago, people went to people like me and they would compose music. And now they'll go to, license something from Beyonce or... Christina,
really,
like
right,
that.
Right.
It's so, a much different industry.
It's so funny because I just saw someone was commenting on that on Instagram or somewhere where, it used to be a professional pride if you were a published musician that you wouldn't put your music on commercials. Now, Portugal the Man was sponsoring products before while the music was still in the charts.
Right. And the only person that still doesn't do it is Springsteen.
Really, that's it.
As far as I know.
And so that's trickled down and you feel that.
Yes, and I'd say a good 40-50% of the business are they're licensing music from either known artists or from music libraries. And, the thing about technology is that it's changed the way music is made. So, it's reduced like the fees and stuff. So somebody says, "Well, I'll do a piece of music for $500."
So it's cheaper.
It's made it a lot cheaper.
Is it easier?
I'm not sure the business is easier because when you're working with advertising agencies, you're still dealing with the creatives and they want specific things.
Right.
But I think there's a lot more resources to get music.
Is it the kind of business that could raise your blood pressure?
Yes.
And that's why Ira's here. Ira,
that's exactly right.
Ira's blood pressure problem has brought him into the Allstate Showcase studio. Tell me about that.
Well, just a long story. As I said, I'm a music composer and producer and went to my cardiologist and he said, your blood pressure is sort of out of control. I'm 60 years old. I have a family. I have a young child. He's 9. And I'm like, he's like, you have to get this under control. It's very dangerous. And I'm like, well, what is it? And the thing that I learned is, think of it this way, high blood pressure is basically putting extra stress on your heart, which means, and your arteries. So that means more heart attacks or more strokes.
So they gave you medicine.
Gave me medicine.
You didn't like the medicine.
Hate the medicine. Still hate the medicine. I'm like, I need to figure out a way naturally to lower this. And I did a lot of research, foods, drinks, and I kept reading about the same 6 or 7 natural ingredients with studies that lower your blood pressure. And I'm like, well, if pomegranate juice lowers your blood pressure and beet juice lowers your blood pressure and hibiscus tea lowers your blood pressure, I'm sure somebody put it together. And I started researching, and there was no functional beverage to lower blood pressure or to normalize it, as we saw.
So you took over your wife's kitchen.
Almost threw me out to this day. And I started, making this. I would make them in gallons. And I'd go to Whole Foods, buy all the ingredients, and I decided it has to be 8 ounces.
And why is that? Why did you say 8 ounces?
I just thought if somebody was going to drink something every day, 16 ounces is a lot. So I decided it should be 8, and I created it proportionally based on that.
And so but you're not a doctor.
No.
And I've got you on talking about product. I'm a little apprehensive.
Absolutely.
Because this isn't medically approved or anything like that.
Correct.
So if as a small business guy selling this juice,
here's what we say. We're saying that all of the ingredients and on our website, 120life.com, we show you all the studies. And there is, and if you drink this, the idea is you could say, wow, I saw the study on beets that it lowers your blood pressure 7%. I saw the study on pomegranates, and this guy put it all together. And we don't claim this is the only way to help lower your blood pressure. We think this could be one of many things. The most important thing if for anybody listening out there is you have to reduce your salt. If you don't reduce your salt, it's not going to change. Right. So that's so.
And that's free advice because you don't have a salt remover in this bottle.
I do not have a salt remover.
And so, as a business guy who's gone from music to, do you put bottles in your wagon and walk up and down the street, or how's that going?
You know, it's actually, I was talking to Tom before, and he said, look, you know, there are not many people that are 60 years old that are adventurous, willing to do their new startup. And it's sort of the way I live my life. If I believe in something, I try it. Knowing nothing about this, I just started to find the right people, and I'm like, we're going to do this.
How do you sell it? Do you sell it in, you get it to stores? Or?
No. Early on, I decided, you know, there's so many, you go into Whole Foods or Mariano's, and there's thousands of drinks for sale. Right. I'm like, this is so specific. We're going to start online. We hired a great advertising agency, Epsilon. I knew a lot of the people there, and they target. They basically drive people with high blood pressure to our website.
And it's called, again, 120?
120 Life, L-I-F-E.
And what's the website?
It's 120life.com.
So what you need to do then, Ira, is you need to get Bruce Springsteen to let you use a song, advertise it, and the rest would be history.
There we go.
It's nice to see you. Interesting story. Keep us posted, will you?
Yeah, I appreciate your time.
Thank you
so much.
It's the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN.
This is the Wintrust Business Minute.
Got a minute? Good, because I've got the Wintrust Business Minute. Sharing the news, providing input, and breaking down the stories that matter to the world of business. It may seem like old news, but when we're talking about $500 million, it's going to turn some heads. Remember the name Bernie Madoff? Well, the victims from his Ponzi scheme are still seeing their payback with news last week that $504 million will be distributed to 21,000 people, totaling reimbursements from the Department of Justice to $1.3 billion. And speaking of big money, Michael Farrow, former chairman of the newspaper publisher Trunk, is planning to sell his 25% stake of the company, worth $206 million. This comes after his announcement to step down from his chairman position shortly following a report detailing sexual harassment allegations through work. So who's filling that financial void? The famous McCormick family. McCormick Media, to be exact. I guess we'll see what's next with the publishing industry and its fight to stay relevant in the digital age. Tune in tomorrow for all of your up-to-date business news on WGN Radio.
Back to Steve Bertrand and the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
Thanks, Bennett, and Doma T. Violetta as well. It is the Business Lunch on 720. In the studio is Randy Schaefer. She's a digital editor for the Chicago Tribune. Comes by on most Mondays in April when it snows.
So this one time, hopefully.
Hopefully. You know, the average high is 59 degrees today.
Don't tell me that.
The Cubs have already canceled. It's going to be maybe, if we're lucky, 38 a little bit later. Nice day to stay inside and look at all those ads targeting you on Facebook.
That was very specific.
I know. You like that? And that's what the ads are all about, right? So you pulled this piece for me from TechCrunch about, and it's kind of the guy has a sort of twisted path he takes, but he's talking about this idea, first of all, if people would pay to be free of ads in Facebook. So would you pay $7 a month to have an ad-free Facebook?
Well, I absolutely would. Would you?
Would you? The ads don't bother me that much.
Really?
No, they really don't. I guess I'm not, I use Facebook in a weird way. I don't use it. It's typical because it's more public,
right?
So I'm not really following people I know, and I just kind of work from the notification, so I don't notice the ads.
Well, so this idea was also pitched that not only could a subscription-based service make Facebook ad-free, but it could also help you control a little better what you didn't want to see in your feeds. So,
right.
Like, too many baby photos, too many multi-level marketing schemes, you know, with the potential, like, Facebook subscription model, you could get rid of those. And this is, of course, all just hypothetical, and this was discussed after Zuckerberg's congressional testimony last week.
Well, see, it seems to me the damage from Facebook isn't the ads, it's the fake stories that are spread by all of us,
right? Russians.
Right, yeah, isn't it? Isn't that where the damage is done?
Yeah, and I think that, you know, that's something that you can throw money at the problem, but it's not going to fix it.
Exactly.
You know, you can try to say, like, hey, I want less of this, I'll pay $7 a month, but the people that are still seeing those damaging stories, you know, they're going to be the people that aren't paying $7 a month,
and they're going to be the people spreading the bad
exactly
stories anyway.
right.
Okay, so would you pay? You would pay?
I would pay, yes.
I would not pay, I don't think, because it doesn't bother me that much.
Right, well, I will be sure to avoid your login then, so I don't have to see the ads.
So then the next question then is, if they do offer this paywall, will the people who don't pay appreciate not paying more? And that's put very inarticulately. You look confused, but I'm hoping you can explain it.
Well, no, and I think that this story, this TechCrunch story, did a good job of saying, you know, kind of like Spotify, where everyone can use Spotify, but if you pay, you get certain privileges, you know, like playing songs in order and being able to download to listen to your phone when you're not connected to the internet. So I think something like that, where it's like, yeah, you know, like you're getting this service for free, but you're really paying for like the fringe upgrades, like Spirit Airlines, the Spirit Airlines of the internet.
Right. But so then, but if you are willing to not pay, it makes the ads a little more palatable because it's more of a conscious choice on your part.
Right.
So I'm choosing this route. It's cheap. It's free. So I will live with the ads. I won't curse the ads quite as much.
Yes, because hopefully those ads will be a little more targeted to you.
And so do you think any of this is going to happen?
Probably not, no. I can't see it happening anytime soon.
I mean, part of what Zuckerberg says, to his credit, is that he wants to make this free and available to the world. He wants to tie the world together. Well, I mean,
right.
Obviously it helps him in the bottom line department, but if you start charging, you're going to start automatically excluding a lot of people.
Right, and I thought that that was interesting, where this actual quote from the article that says, Facebook views social networking as a human right.
Right.
Which I thought was kind of crazy. Year 2018.
Yeah, we have to wait till 21, 22 before it's become put in the Constitution as a human right. Instagram, that'll be a human right in 35, 36.
Maybe.
We're still a ways from there. But I'm fascinated. So I was, my son came home from college a few weeks ago and we went out to dinner and I snapped a picture of him and posted right away, you know, Noah's home. We made him eat with us right away and he hates it, right?
Yeah.
And I get this grief instantly from, well, not grief from him, he doesn't really care, but indignation from others that he had not approved the photo.
Oh, no.
And so now I'm learning about all this approving the photos, and the kids were together last weekend. We had to take like 6 pictures before both approved. And it really speaks to how we don't see reality on Instagram.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, we're, your generation especially, still kind of getting used to it. Mine is, we're pretty well adjusted, but the generation below me, these Gen Zers, this is what they've grown up with. They've grown up watching themselves and like watching this distorted filter on reality thanks to social media.
And it is distorted, and it changes the way we behave, I think, in so many. I mean, there's the one thing where you can say, and if you're used to it, then you give certain weight to what you see.
Right.
Right. But on the posting side of it, it's like people are now afraid to just be who they are. They can't
right.
be who they are.
Right. Unless you're a teenage girl with 5 different Instagram accounts, and then you can be yourself on 3 of those.
And that really happens.
This does, yeah. This piece that I sent you earlier for Maclean's, a Canadian publication, explained kind of how teenage girls use social media. And a lot of them, they will have multiple accounts that are, they curate some of them. Some of them are for friends and family, you know.
Right. And so what they're creating are 5 different identities.
Right, exactly. And the name of this piece aptly is Social Media is a Full-Time Job for Teen Girls.
And so of those 5 personalities, maybe one of them is genuine or none of them is genuine?
You know, good question. Teenage girls, a lot of times, I don't think they
I guess
really
they're
know
never
who
genuine.
They are.
Right, exactly.
Right.
It takes
I was a
while. A
teenage girl once, you know, I get it.
Yeah, me too. Well, wait, that's not true. So there's that with the teenage girls. Take that to the millennials and the homebuyers, and even there, where you're seeing social media impact, why millennials, we find now, are finally starting to buy homes. What's leading them to buy a house?
Right. Well, so this, so USA Today, Paul Davidson said that the head of consumer lending for Bank of America says that Instagram and Facebook are what are making millennials buy homes. I don't think that's the case.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, people in my generation are just of home buying age. And I don't think it's the FOMO from seeing your friends get a house on Instagram. I think it's just that.
But that's their theory, right? Their theory
right.
is people are posting on Instagram pictures of them in their new house.
Right. And then other people are like, oh, I want a house. So-and-so did it.
Right. And well, that's kind of like the age long thing, right? That's what
right.
we've always done.
Right.
The grass is always greener. We see someone else buy a house and then we think we need to do it as well.
And then you have a lawn and you have to mow it and you kind of want to move back in and deal with the condo HOA.
Wow, you've got that crystal ball going. That's exactly where we are. So, right. So we're going to dismiss this suit.
Yeah. I think that this is people buy homes. People don't buy homes. I don't think it has anything to do with social media. And
what about the fact that taking pictures in Instagram worthy sort of views?
That one has some pull for me.
Right. So there's the restaurants that will create an Instagram wall.
Right.
Where people can go and post.
Which we've talked about before.
So another article then that says that decorating is becoming sort of driven by what is a good Instagram post.
Yeah. This Forbes piece that says 72% of Instagram users have purchased something that they saw on the app.
Say that again.
72% of Instagram users have purchased something for their home that they saw on the app.
So they're on Instagram, they're looking and they see Instagram posts, advertisements,
yeah.
and they'll buy something because it looks good in that room on an Instagram, so they buy it for their house.
Yep.
Well, okay, let's do the same standard then. Isn't that the same as if they were flipping through McCall's 30 years ago or Good Housekeeping 25 years ago?
Never heard of McCall's.
Oh, that's my point, though. Back then, back then it was things posted
absolutely
in magazines.
And it's just a different medium now. You know, we're always going to call inspiration from the things that we like, and it just so happens that these are apps now instead of home catalogs and magazines.
So is the resolution to all of this that it's all of normal behavior? It's just a different medium?
I guess we'll find out once the Constitution addresses it and we get an amendment for our social media rights.
Randy Schaefer is a digital editor at the Tribune. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you for having me.